Ireland in the early part of the 20th century was gripped by a wave of working class revolt. For the first time in history, the unskilled workers were involved in trade union activity on a mass scale. Starting from the 1907 dock workers' strike in Belfast to the famous Dublin General lockout in 1913, unskilled workers, the most exploited, the most vulnerable, the most unorganised section of the working class, stood up to their sweating employers and fought back with a tenacity and unbridled militancy not seen before. A spirit of solidarity and working class consciousness grew up in Irish workers. And this period of the early 20th century is the heyday for syndicalism, not only in Ireland, but also in places like the United States, in Australia, and also in Britain. So this is the period in which we have the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, figures like Tom Mann coming to centre stage. And syndicalism grew up as a reaction to the compromises and sellouts of the established unions and reformist parliamentary parties. They wanted to build a different sort of unionism. Instead of vehicles for conciliation and compromise, they wanted the trade unions to be vehicles for class war, vehicles committed to destroying capitalism and establishing a society based on workers' control. So who was Jim Larkin? Well, he was born in Liverpool, in England, to poverty-stricken Irish parents in 1876. He left school when he was 11, and by the age of, by the 1890s, Larkin had found work on the city docks. And by 1903, he'd risen to the trusted position of foreman on the docks. And Larkin only joined the Dock Workers Union a few years earlier before becoming a foreman. But he didn't get involved in union activity to begin with, in the main because of his political ideas. Before Larkin became a trade unionist, he was a staunch socialist, having joined the Independent Labour Party in the early 1890s. Like most socialists at the time, Larkin had little time for trade unions, which he regarded as accomplices of capitalism, and he considered trade union activity to be a diversion that strikes have hurt the working class more than they hurt the employers. And so the only way forward to socialism was to elect socialists into office and, you know, proceed from there. But all of this was to change in 1905. Larkin was transformed from a card-holding member of a union into a militant trade unionist when there was a strike at his workplace involving around 800 workers going out on strike, trying to demand a closed shop, trying to demand the rest of the foreman join the union. And it developed into a bitter dispute in which the company imported scab labour, and this dispute lasted for 13 weeks. And Larkin was elected onto the strike committee, and he very soon became the driving force behind the strike. And although the strike was eventually defeated, Larkin's experiences had transformed him from a woolly ballot box socialist into an aggressive trade union organiser. So I think Larkin is a very good example of how people aren't just sort of born revolutionaries. It's their experiences, it's the fire of class struggle that can transform people's ideas. Now out of work, Larkin was taken on as a full-time organiser for the Dock Workers Union. And the union movement, so he's taken on around sort of 1906, and then he's sent to Belfast in 1907 to try and organise the docks. And the union movement in Belfast at the time was very much dominated by the British-based craft unions, which are basically unions for skilled workers. And these unions were as organisationally advanced as any union in England. But the position for unskilled workers, for seasonal and casual labourers, was vastly different. And the dock workers were amongst the most deprived sections of the working class in the city. Most labourers on the docks didn't have permanent jobs. They were taken on as daily needed, and they had to sort of wait around the hiring hall and weren't sure if they could get any work. So as you can imagine, this is a very precarious life, very vulnerable, and also they earned quite miserable wages. The unskilled, with few exceptions, were totally unorganised, and previous attempts to organise the unskilled had been successfully broken by repression of the employers in tandem with the state. On his arrival to Belfast, Larkin announced his intention to preach the divine gospel of discontent, and he made good on his promise. Within 3 months of arriving in Belfast, 2,900 dock workers out of 3,000 were in the union. And he'd also organised most of the carters on the docks, and carters are those who sort of, I guess, transport what's unloaded the docks around the city. From these figures, you can get this real image of, you know, this tour de force, this sort of, you know, this tornado descending on the city and whipping up and bringing fire to the working class. And the employers responded, as they had always responded, to this dock workers' new agitation by locking out union members. And it was a full-scale attempt to break the union. Larkin responded by spreading the dispute, by stepping up the pressure. Not only did he bring out the dock workers, then he brought out the carters, and the struggle sort of spiralled into involving other sections of the working class. Coal miners went on strike, tobacco workers were on strike, and even the police mutinied in this period, demanding better wages and conditions. Picket lines were established to prevent scab labour from entering the docks. Police were stoned, and vehicles that scabs used were attacked, were set on fire, were thrown into the river, or at the same, both of those things. So Larkin himself was arrested for assaulting a scab who had hit three picketers before being felled with a shovel. During the strike, mass meetings of 5,000 to 10,000 workers were held daily, and it's at these meetings that Larkin would speak with a trumpet tongue of resistance. Indeed, Larkin's speeches are what he's remembered most for. They were so powerful because he seemed to know how to voice the anger, the discontent, the pain, the joy, the hope, the fighting spirit that sort of existed in the crowd. And this is sort of from the accounts about the power of, when Larkin came to speak. He spoke bluntly and with in bold terms, and often with a great deal of humour as well. And I think one of the most memorable lines of Larkin was when he was launching the Dock Workers Union in Dublin. And he said that he regretted the injury inflicted on an army officer with a broken bottle in Belfast with the observation that it was a bad thing to disgrace a common bottle by using it on an officer. Probably the most significant thing about the Belfast strike was that it established a precedent for the city of Belfast, getting large numbers of Protestant and Catholic workers to stand together to stand up against the troops and the police. In a city known for sectarianism, mass meetings in support of the strikers were held in both Protestant and Catholic areas of the city. And in one spectacular display of unity, over 100,000 workers marched down the Protestant Shankill Road in a march involving both Orange Order, or pro-British Protestant, pro-British Protestant organisation, and nationalist flute bands playing together. And despite attempts by all manner of forces to whip up sectarian animosity, the workers remained largely united throughout the strike. This history, I think, is a really exciting example of the potential unity between Protestant and Catholic workers on the basis of stressing their unity as members of the working class. It shows the way that class struggle tends to cut across all divisions in the working class. But the strike was eventually broken by the intervention of the British leadership of the Dock Workers Union. Over the head of Larkin, figures like James Sexton negotiated a rotten deal, getting one section of the strikers, the carters, to return to work having achieved some of their goals and leaving the dock workers isolated and doomed to defeat. And the role of the union officials in betraying the dockers was an important lesson for Larkin, something he would remember and was determined would never happen again. Soon after the defeat of the strike, Larkin leaves for Dublin in search of greater opportunities to organise the unskilled, and you sort of get this sense that Larkin has this perpetual need for motion. But unfortunately, Larkin failed to leave behind a coherent body of opinion welded into a political organisation. When the working class was feeling confident, hopeful and full of militancy, Larkin's brand of syndicalism, of aggressive industrial struggle, could overcome the sectarian divide. But when the militancy died down and demoralisation set in, there was no political organisation grouped based on grouping together workers that were the most politically conscious, the most determined class fighters, that could continue Larkin's arguments about the need for working class solidarity, about the fact that the main enemy were the employers. There was no organisation that could help maintain the great advances in unity that were made. And so by 1912, Belfast was gripped by reaction, with thousands of Catholics and hundreds of so-called rotten prods, often union activists, were driven from their jobs in sectarian pogroms on the docks and in the shipyards. Now, while the Belfast struggle was underway, Larkin was at work successfully establishing branches of the Dock Workers Union in every major port of Ireland. But despite his successes, Larkin's militant methods increasingly brought him into conflict with the British-based union leadership, who were concerned that Larkin's brand of industrial militancy would spill over into England and unsettle their control over the unions. And so Larkin was eventually suspended from office. So suspended from the Dockers Union, frustrated with the conservative approach of established unions, and determined to wage a campaign to organise the unskilled workers of Ireland, Larkin now launches a breakaway union, the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, in December of 1908. And between the period of 1911 and 1913, the Transport Workers' Union securely establishes itself, and it begins with around 3,000 members, but by 1913 has 30,000 members. And this time, and during this time, it played a major role in organising what was a massive wave of unrest that was sweeping over Ireland. Belfast only heralded the beginning of the stirrings of the unskilled. Workers from one end of Ireland to the other were making demands on their employers. Newsboys, clothing workers, golf caddies, tanners, maltsters, not that I know what they are, dairy workers and tramway men all clamoured for wage increases. And now this upheaval of the unskilled in Ireland has to be seen as part and parcel of what was going on in Britain at the time as well. It's known as the Great Unrest. And it was a series of mass strikes which were convulsing Britain from 1910 until the outbreak of the First World War. And the characteristics of the strike, I think this sort of massive strike wave, are well characterised by the historian Walter Kendall. And he wrote, "The mass strike wave of 1910 to 1914 remains unique in British history. A wild, elemental, pent-up force seems suddenly let loose, disregarding precedent and agreements, impatient of compromise, shaking the old complacent trade unionism by the ears. The trade union leaders, almost to a man, deplored it. The government viewed it with alarm. Disregarding everything, encouraged only by a small minority of syndicalist leaders, the great strike wave rolled on, threatening to sweep everything away before it." And as we've seen, Larkin's union was very much established as a revolt against the betrayals of the British leadership. For Larkin, the union should be a weapon for the assertion of workers' economic power, an instrument for clubbing the capitalists over the head, and not an instrument for compromise. For Larkin, the system of capitalism was a disease which could not be smoothed over or healed with a few bandages. And in his words, it was a root remedy that needed applying. And you can get a good sense of the ideological contours of the labour revolt in Ireland and the principles around which Larkin built the Transport Workers' Union by reading editions of his weekly newspaper, The Irish Worker. Launched in 1911, Larkin edited this newspaper and wrote a prodigious amount for it. And it had a readership of around 10 times that of the nationalist weekly paper, the Sinn Féin, which gives you some idea of the success of Larkin's paper and also the hold with which Larkin's ideas had over the working class. And one historian, the official historian of the union, says that it was pretty much read by every working class person in the whole of Dublin, which might be an overstatement, but nonetheless. Now, the Irish Worker was ferociously partisan. It warmly praised friends, but directed a constant stream of abuse at scabs, employers who paid low wages and denied rights of trade union organisation, enemies of every description. And an indication of Larkin's style can be gained from an article called A Call to Arms, where he wrote that, "At present you spend your lives in sordid labour and have your abode in filthy slums. Your children hunger and your masters say your slavery must endure forever. If you would come out of bondage, you yourself must forge the weapons and fight the grim battle." And the weapons that workers needed to use to fight this grim battle were embodied in the principles of working class solidarity, the idea that an injury to one is an injury to all. This was the core around which everything else revolved. Any section of workers in dispute could rely on the active support of the rest of the union. Picket lines were not to be crossed, and tainted goods which had been produced by scab labour were not to be touched. The solidarity strike was a crucial instrument to break employer resistance so that no group of workers were ever allowed to go down defeated in isolation. The solution to the evils of capitalism was trade union organisation, according to syndicalists, and in particular the building of one big union, which would embrace all categories of workers, irrespective of religious, sectarian, racial or craft divisions. One big union could ensure the employer confronted a working class standing shoulder to shoulder. And building up workers' economic organisation to the point where they could take control of the industry was seen as a key way to topple the existing order and establish a society based on workers' control. And if people know anything about the transition from feudalism to capitalism, it's kind of this idea that, you know, the workers would, like the capitalists, would build up their economic power under the structures of capitalism and then would, you know, take over and would have a, I guess, revolution to some extent. So for syndicalists, the problems of trade union bureaucracy, their role in keeping a tight lid on the struggle of preventing the struggles breaking out into revolutionary challenges, could be solved by getting the right kind of trade union organisation, getting the right kind of structures, by creating one big union and by making sure that the right people were the ones that, the right people, the most sufficiently revolutionary, were the ones which led it. So they didn't accept the Marxist argument that the development of a trade union bureaucracy is an inevitable part, a product of the nature of trade unions under capitalism. But people can sort of flesh this out a little bit more in discussion. Nonetheless, syndicalism did represent a revolutionary current in the workers' movement, even if it wasn't fully developed or mature. In the words of the great Russian revolutionary, Leon Trotsky, syndicalists not only wanted to fight the bourgeoisie, but unlike reformist trade union leaders or parliamentary parties, they really wanted to tear off its head. Importantly, though, Larkin was not only concerned with questions of economics, getting better wages and conditions. His union also took a stand around political questions. It supported women's suffrage, and it was a staunchly Republican organisation opposed to the British occupation of Ireland. But while Larkin's union stood for the achievement of national independence and so represented the biggest Republican organisation in Dublin at the time, the kind of free Ireland which Larkin was fighting for was not one which the British flag was replaced by the green flag, while everything else remained much the same, with the employers and the landlords exploiting and oppressing the working class. No, Larkin wanted not only national freedom, but he also wanted an end to wage slavery, an end to capitalism. A lot of the biographies of Larkin emphasise the unsystematic character of his approach, the way in which he was sort of this instinctive militant and not much of a theoretician. They contrast him with James Connolly, a leading Irish Marxist and syndicalist, who was also appointed by Larkin to organise the Belfast section of the Transport Workers' Union. So Larkin's compared with Connolly. So for Jack Murphy, who was a working-class intellectual in Britain, Larkin was the tornado and Connolly was the lighthouse. Larkin could whip up a storm, but Connolly could explain the situation. Now, this is true to a certain extent. Larkin, unlike Connolly, didn't make any theoretical contribution to socialist theory. But it's wrong to see that Larkin was purely a preacher of discontent and rebellion. He also articulated a vision for a radically different society, for a new social order in which the working class were in the saddle and running the show. For Larkin, the union was the means for laying down an alternative social order. The union offered a whole view of society which was starkly at odds with the prevailing ideas. Against possessive individualism that dominated capitalist society, the collective virtues of brotherhood, of fraternity, of solidarity were championed. And so the union was seen as both a vehicle for overthrowing capitalism, but also an embryo for a future social society. It was a means for raising up the working class, for fostering and developing the self-respect needed if they were going to be able to transform society for themselves. And in all of these ideas about what the role of the union was, the role of the political organisation was very much seen as an auxiliary to the main organisation, the trade union. Larkin saw the role of political organisations was to act as a sort of socialist propaganda machine, something separate from the industrial struggle that wouldn't actually intervene actively into the struggles that were happening. Okay, so while the Transport Workers' Union had branches throughout the country, the real heart of the union was in Dublin. There wasn't much industry in Dublin, so most of the workers were unskilled and employed in things like transport and the docks. The conditions in Dublin were really extreme. The wages were something like half that were in London. They had around about 20% unemployment. Most families lived in single-room flats in run-down tenements, and the slums in Dublin at the time were sort of likened to what was in Calcutta in India, to give you some extent of the poverty. And this poverty and casual employment made Dublin a very difficult city for trade union organisation. But by the summer of 1913, Larkin was claiming that the workers of Dublin were the best organised in any city of the world. And he was right to boast. The union seemed to have a veritable stranglehold over the city, and the working class were confident and full of hope. Few employers cared to challenge the union head on. But there was one important exception, and that was William Murphy, who is the most important Catholic Ireland's most powerful capitalist. William Murphy was not only somebody who owned the tramways, as well as the independent Irish independent newspaper. He also owned the biggest department store and the biggest hotel in the city. He was also an important figure for the Nationalist Home Rule movement, so the movement that was trying to get a degree of autonomy for Ireland. And William Murphy was not only determined to exclude the Union from his own empire, but he wanted to smash the Union throughout the entire city. Larkin, on the other hand, was determined to organise Murphy's empire and make the Union the dominant force in the city. So as you can see, there's going to be a bit of a confrontation. And this confrontation led to a serious conflict between capital and labour known as the Dublin Lockout. Lasting over 6 months, the lockout really gave us a glimpse of the fundamental division in Irish society, that between the working class and the capitalist class. And it is without a doubt the most important industrial struggle in Irish history. The Dublin Lockout began with Murphy striking first in August, sacking union members from his newspaper and then some workers from the tramways, and Larkin responded as in his usual fashion by bringing out workers in other sections of Murphy's empire, and the strike just kind of escalated as more and more employers joined in trying to impose on their workers an undertaking that they pledged that they won't join the Transport Workers Union, and when they refused to sign this pledge, they were locked out. And so by the end of September, Dublin was in a grip of general lockout that involved altogether more than a third of Dublin's population. Larkin's union was now fighting for its life. And in this struggle between Irish workers and Catholic nationalist employers, the state, the police and the British authorities were far from neutral. The role of the state was to throw its full weight behind the employers, irrespective of whether they were Catholic nationalists like Murphy or not. And a few days into the strike, they arrested Larkin and the rest of the union leadership for sedition, and they banned union demonstrations. And when the workers were defiant and said, well, we're going to organise demonstrations regardless, the police set about clubbing people indiscriminately to clear the streets. The police also invaded people's homes and smashed up their furniture and beat men, women and children in their homes. And over one weekend, which was sort of the spike of the violence, around the 30th to 31st of August, two union members were clubbed to death and over 400 were badly injured. The police really wanted to teach the workers a lesson they wouldn't forget. And to deal with the attacks of the police and strikers, the Transport Union organised its own self-defence force, the Citizens' Army. While the Citizens' Army, which armed around a few hundred workers with metal-shod clubs, was never strong enough to really stop the importation of scabs, it was effective in deterring the police from repeating their worst excesses. And this intimate connection between state and capital, which was displayed openly during the Dublin lockout, shows up some of the weaknesses with syndicalist ideas and practice. For syndicalists like Larkin, the key way, as we sort of went through, was to topple the existing order was to build up economic organisation to the point where they could take over the factories. While syndicalists might want to tear off the head of the bourgeoisie, this really was not enough. They needed to develop a thoroughgoing conception of how to take political power. They needed to have a worked out conception of how to destroy the capitalist state. Importantly, they needed a revolutionary workers' party like Lenin and the Bolsheviks had. They had a cadre that was clear on the tasks at hand. To break the deadlock, Larkin increasingly looked to British unions for solidarity. The appeal of the Irish workers did not fall on deaf ears. Their cause was enthusiastically taken up by the rank and file of the British labour movement. Larkin addressed mass rallies throughout England, Scotland and Wales. Hundreds of thousands of pounds were raised, mostly by the contributions of rank and file workers. Food ships were sent over to Dublin to try and aid the workers in their war of attrition with the bosses. But the thing was, the workers in Dublin needed more than money and food. They also needed solidarity strike action that could isolate the Dublin employers and really break the deadlock. There was an unofficial wave of strike action throughout the country. For example, when Larkin was jailed for the second time, there was a campaign to free Larkin, and there were calls made throughout Britain for a general strike. And with miners and railway workers out on strike, the British government was compelled to release Larkin from jail, showing, I think, the potential that solidarity action and the power that it had to be able to actually come to the aid of the Dublin workers. The biggest obstacle to solidarity action was therefore not the racism of the rank and file British workers. Larkin was considered a hero to thousands of British workers. And I think that the sort of action and the degree of enthusiasm and support for the Dublin workers really sort of pushes against the dominant ideas about Irish history of all the Irish struggling against all the bigoted British. The biggest obstacle was the opposition, the biggest obstacle was the opposition of the trade union bureaucracy. The trade union officials were more concerned to see off the challenge that Larkinism imposed to their own positions than they were to help save the Dublin workers. For example, when several thousand railway workers went on strike in support of the Dublin workers, they were ordered back by their officials. And the crunch really came when a special conference of the British trade union movement was organised in December to discuss the lockout, and they voted to oppose any further action. And actually, importantly, it was the left-wing official, Ben Tillett, who'd been on these platforms with Larkin on his sort of fiery crusade across England, who wielded the knife and sort of backed the motion opposing any solidarity strike action. The British militants, many of which were active socialists and syndicalists, were just not organised to wrest control from the hands of the officials. To prevent the betrayal, they needed an independent political organisation once again, which could provide an alternative political leadership to the officials who wanted to contain the struggles. They needed an independent political organisation that could give confidence to the workers who wanted to launch widespread industrial action. And the refusal to support solidarity strike action really did seal the fate of the Dublin workers, who went down to a crushing defeat. The Transport Workers' Union, which appeared to have Dublin securely in its grasp in the early summer of 1913, had been broken by the employers and the state, assisted by the British Trade Union Congress. The union survived as an organisation, but the movement of working class revolt was smashed, and the seemingly irresistible wave of Larkinism was turned back, and workers were thrown into complete disorganisation. The employers now launched an all-out offensive, slashing wages, and union membership slumped. And Larkin once again leaves defeat for America to raise funds for the union, which was now bankrupt. So, for me, the tragedy of the general lockout was that despite the great militancy, there was no attempt to build an organisation grouping the best militants. The syndicalists had operated on assumption that workers' consciousness was even and that it was always progressing ever onward and upwards. There was no understanding of the way in which defeats, such as 1913 or indeed Belfast 1907, could have a temporary but devastating impact on workers' consciousness, that if things don't go forward, they go rapidly backwards. And this weakness meant that Larkin couldn't explain the wave that in the wake of the lockout, why workers who had fought so heroically could join the British Army only 9 months later to fight in the First World War. If Larkin had organised the minority of workers who had drawn the sharpest lessons from the lockout into an organisation, the workers' movement could have retreated from the lockout in a better position, retaining a core of workers still committed to Larkin's understanding that the key struggle in society was that of class against class, that this was the central division. But I think to give Larkin and the syndicalists a little bit of slack, the key role that a revolutionary organisation plays in overthrowing capitalism really wasn't clear until the success of the Bolsheviks in Russia. And following the Bolshevik success, many of the best syndicalists were convinced to join, were convinced of this project to building an organisation, and joined many of the new communist parties. Indeed, while Larkin was in the US, he actually helped found the American Communist Party. And I want to flag just very briefly that the defeat of the Dublin workers in 1913 had not only a devastating impact on workers, but it also had a very important impact on the trajectory of events in Ireland. Tumultuous struggles lay ahead, with agitation around national grievances reaching fever pitch during the East Uprising in 1916 and the subsequent War of Independence. But with the workers' movement in disarray, the nationalist organisations such as the Irish Volunteers and Sinn Féin, organisations that had lined up with the employers and the British state in crushing the Dublin workers, now took the lead. And so with workers' organisations now sidelined, these nationalist forces now managed to prevent the struggle against British imperialism spilling over into a socialist revolution. So instead of, fusing what James Connolly argued for, fusing the nationalist and socialist struggles together, we got partition, which entrenched sectarianism and produced, in the words of Connolly again, a festival of reaction both sides of the border for many decades. Nonetheless, I want to finish by emphasising the real strengths of Larkin and revolutionary syndicalism in Ireland. For the workers who fought the police on the streets, who withstood months of hunger and want, who defied the condemnation of the Catholic Church and press abuse, trade union organisation meant something much more than the struggle to establish moderate, responsible trade unions. The unskilled workers of Ireland were fighting for their dignity, for their right to live like human beings instead of slaves. And during the stormy years of class struggle, Larkin's revolutionary syndicalism, his support for an aggressive industrial struggle, his insistence that the key struggle in Ireland was one of class against class, his insistence on the need for working class solidarity, and his vision of a socialist reorganising society held sway with the mass of workers. It showed that many of the ideas that are treated as fringe today could explain, could connect with the experiences of workers living under capitalism, and above all, in the cauldron of struggle, the struggle of workers against boss and state, these ideas could gain a mass following.